Good evening and welcome to Dirty Secrets of Small Business. You know, it's 7 o'clock on Wednesday. You can set your clocks on that because we're always here. And we're talking about small business stuff. What that means is that we take it. We're business coaches. When I say we, I'm here with my long-term partner in business, Adam Sunhalter. We've been together for over 15 years. And we have a company called Maximum Value Partners, at which we coach small business owners on how to make profits, how to get their hands around their business, and how to do the right kind of stuff to have some fun. And we're here tonight, as well as you know, the longtime listeners. We have a program which basically takes from our coaching annuals.
We got flowers going on, all right.
It's springtime, just the natural, right? So we take our experiences from the last couple of weeks and we usually put it into a show. And we also have very interesting guests, and that's what we have tonight. We have Michael Robinson from Rust Belt Riders. And we're going to have some fun with him, and he's going to tell us about his business, which is very exciting, very unique. And he and his team are a bunch of very interesting guys. And we're going to interview him tonight and hear about his story. So, Adam, why don't you talk about food composting
I can get things started here. Yeah, well, welcome to Dirty Secrets of Small Business. Good to have everybody here. Before I get Michael on here, just so you guys know, you're always welcome to be part of the show, and probably the easiest way to do that is with the following number, which we use for a call. If you call in and you're nice to Scotty, we may let you on the air. If not, we'll probably kick you off. But you can either call in or you can text in using the same number, which is 440-946-9468. Again, 440-946-9468. So yeah, we have Michael in studio today, and Michael's here a couple things. He's going to talk about his company, Rust Belt Riders, and Michael is also a graduate of the Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Business Program. So we'll get into that detail as well here, but he's here as part of that stuff as well. So welcome to the show, Michael. Glad to have you here in studio.
Thank you very much for having me on. Happy to be here.
So we had a good chance to kind of meet with Michael and take a tour of his facility. It's a very, very unique facility and some good stuff kind of going on there. And we wanted to bring him on the air and kind of talk about that. But first of all, I wanted to have you give you a chance to kind of just give us a little background on you, kind of where you grew up. Because Michael's, for those of you who are just kind of coming in here, Michael's not from the area, but he's fallen in love with the Cleveland area. But I want to give Michael a little chance to kind of give a little background on himself, kind of where you grew up, kind of how you... your story and how you got here to Cleveland.
So Michael's a real ambassador to Cleveland and for Cleveland, and that's nice to see. It really is. You know, Cleveland has a little bit of a complex that every year gets chipped away because it shouldn't have a complex, a negative one. Yeah. So when we hear stories like yours, it's kind of exciting for us.
Yeah, it's I'm a transplant. I'm very happy to be here. Moved here in 2013. Originally, I'm from Illinois. I grew up in Aurora, and after finishing high school, went to Loyola Chicago, studied social and political philosophy, and after graduating there, as the other co-founder, Daniel Brown, and myself, we were both in Chicago together, and we had a whole bunch of friends that were, they were mutual friends, but he and I never really spent too much time together in Chicago. So, basically, I was on a bicycle trip. I was going from Chicago. The final destination was supposed to be Philadelphia. Didn't quite work out that way. I was outside of Cleveland, and I knew that Dan was there, and I had another friend that was going to law school at Case at the time. And I gave him a phone call and said, "Hey, we got these big baskets that are carrying our gear on our bicycles." I was with a friend of mine, and the gear was too heavy for the baskets, so I started to shake the baskets off, and "Hey, do you think you could come scoop us up and we're going to fix these bikes in Cleveland and go on from there?" So I got picked up, and Dan gave me a tour of the city. I fell in love with the city. We went camping later that weekend. Had a bunch of really great food at a number of restaurants that were in the area. There was a lot of new farm-to-table restaurants that were just opening up. Spice Kitchen and Bar had just opened. So we got a great tour of the city. I saw a lot of opportunity in urban agriculture, and he made a half joke of an offer. At the time, there was a community garden at East 40th and St. Clair, and he was working on this garden, and he made a half joke of an offer. There were already two guys living in a one-bedroom over in Gordon Square, and he said, "If you want to move back in the springtime, when it starts to thaw out a little bit, we could use an extra set of hands in the garden. You can live in the attic." So March rolled around, and I said, "Hey Dan, remember that attic still there? You know, can I still you know, move back?" And yeah, it worked out. I moved back, and then it was through the combination of working in food service in the service industry after graduating Loyola and coming to Cleveland, and then seeing working on the garden and seeing the help that the soils needed that a lot of the community gardens were growing in. So we saw an opportunity to solve a number of problems with this approach. So that's really Rust Belt Writers was born out of that kind of those experiences.
So you come with the urban farming, right? And for those of you who aren't familiar, let me try to do it in layman's terms. That's when people are putting together farms in kind of cities. You know, people used to seeing a farm out in the country, but here's finding areas within the city. Either people are doing it, you know, on their decks, or there's old places that maybe there were buildings there before that have been torn down, and now all of a sudden there's a community garden there, something going on. But a chance to have people grow fresh vegetables and stuff in the city. So this idea of urban farming. So you were obviously aware of that. You came here and you saw what was kind of going on here. It's still kind of a newer trend at that point, what was going on. And you started working at some restaurants, you're saying, too, or kind of see what was happening there.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So, again, philosophy major. So, you know, you weren't thinking about what eventually Rust Belt Writers became. You weren't looking to launch your own business. It was just kind of, you're just kind of going with the flow and heard some good people kind of going on. Let's kind of see where it takes you. So as you're working through that and kind of seeing, so what point does the idea about Rust Belt Writers kind of come up? And why don't you, if you can give people a sense of kind of what Rust Belt is today, but, you know, how did that kind of come about, the whole idea for Rust Belt Writers come about?
Yeah, I think Dan was also, he was an ethics major, so another philosophy
ethics
degree.
Major,
of the five members of our team, there are three philosophy degrees. So
it's amazing how many people graduate with a degree and never come close to using it.
Yeah, you guys probably have some very good discussions. I got
so
to
do. The genesis for Rust Belt, though, I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense that it came from a place of observing these really complicated problems and coming up with innovative solutions to the problem that for us was going to help work on this issue of food waste. So every year we spend $218 billion on food that's grown, transported, and then disposed of. So $218 billion on food waste, on just waste. So
what percent of the overall food is that? Do you guys have a sense for that?
40% is what's
40%.
Wasted. Yeah.
That's U.S.
Yep.
Okay.
Wow. Yeah. All right. So to give an example, we would be able to fill the Cleveland Browns Stadium every single day with food scraps. So when
that
we probably, saw that,
that might have been a better use for the Browns Stadium the last 18 years. Not so much going forward, but
that's right. That would have been a welcome.
That's what it kind of smelled like. That's all right. All right. Sorry.
So it was a.
It's a good visual, though.
We saw this as the problem, and we were working in restaurants at the time. So there are pieces of the. You're not going to eat the green part of the pineapple. Right. Even if you're doing stocks and stuff out of the different vegetable scraps, eventually there's going to be food scraps that are coming out of the kitchen that, you know, we're going to landfills. When they go to landfills, it produces methane, exacerbating climate change. So when we looked at this problem of food waste, we saw an opportunity to decrease the amount of greenhouse gases that are being given off from landfills, but also we came to the work from a place of building out food sovereignty, being able to have folks be able to be connected to their neighborhoods in a way where they're providing food for themselves in those neighborhoods.
Right.
It was really an approach to a broken system that needed systemic change at its core. And that turned itself into what, in the beginning, was a very tactile and sweaty at times solution. We got with some of the restaurants that we were working with and some of the juice bars and cafes, and we raised some money, and we purchased a bicycle and a bicycle trailer, and we were hauling the food scraps around 300 pounds at a time behind a bicycle to the closest community garden. And then we'd work with the community garden to process these scraps into compost that were then able to help build the soils in the community garden plots. And a lot of those are land bank properties or formerly foreclosed buildings. So it's usually a pretty thin layer of topsoil on top and then fill underneath that. So the soils really needed help in terms of biology. So that's where the compost came in.
Okay, so this is all stuff you're seeing as you guys are working, I'll call it your day jobs. Maybe it was a night job because you guys were, you know, maybe working at a restaurant or bar. But again, you're working to pay the bills on stuff, and this is kind of your side project, side hustle. Mm-hmm. So the whole name of Rust Belt Riders, that's where it comes from, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so the Rust Belt is all of us know and love here in Cleveland. That's kind of where we're right in the middle and heart of the Rust Belt, and the Riders part here. Trying to picture probably 3 in the morning, these guys riding on bicycles through downtown Cleveland with something behind them. People probably figure there's a bunch of homeless guys going through the streets or something like that, right? Here they're taking all their belongings.
That's
it's like,
right.
No, this is how a company starts up, folks. This right. is what it looks like to start. You know, when people talk about all this great, wonderful, sexy stuff and everything else, here's where it starts out. It starts out, you know, with, you know, you're freezing your butt off or sweating your butt off in the middle of the night moving stuff around.
Right? You have a lot of dogs chasing you?
No, fortunately, no. No, never issues with dogs. You know, the winter, though, we were only on the bikes for, you know, the first 9 months to a year, I think it was, before we really it was demand we saw that needed to be met, so we had to scale off the bikes. But also there's a much safer way to do that than riding around in a Cleveland February with 300 pounds of foosgrass behind you on a bicycle, that's for sure.
Yes. So this was primarily you and Dan at this point? You guys were doing this stuff? You guys were living together?
Yes, we ran this out of our apartment. We had a nice big loft space over in the Midtown, St. Clair Superior neighborhood. And
so you guys upgraded, moved out of Gordon Square, got a bigger place.
Yeah, so we moved over to the new place, and we had, still the same three of us living there. It was a larger, you know, warehouse live workspace over in St. Clair Superior, and we stored all of our garbage cans there. This was about this time we got our cargo van, so we stored all the containers there that we were using to compost. So in the mornings, I would wake up and open my bedroom door, and there would be 20 64-gallon toter trash cans lined up ready to go. So, and we would wash those out in the apartment at the end of the day, at the end of the shift. So yeah, this was all happening out of our apartment. We were living together. Starting this business together,
Was a third person involved in the company too?
Was at Case for law school, and then once he graduated, he actually lives in Pittsburgh now. He's working for a wind energy firm, helping acquire land to build wind farms.
Okay.
So he was a really important part of the beginning. He would do bike shifts, here and there.
All right, very very unlawyer like. That's great.
Yeah, he's a good guy. I love John.
Hey, well, lawyers are one of those things.
Did you limit your geographic reach? I mean, was there a radius that you could from your apartment basically go and not go beyond? You weren't going deep east side, deep west side. I mean,
No, especially on the bicycles, it was really proximity to a community garden because we needed to be able to haul the material from its place of generation to the. To the composting site at the community garden. So once we got our vehicles, we do have a radius that we use now. It's 25 miles, and we can kind of push that a little bit depending on the potential account. But that's the number we use right now.
Not a lot of technology available in this process at this point, right? I mean, you a lot of just grunt raw labor.
Yeah.
Yeah, again, to your point, Adam, that's how these businesses start. You know,
well,
it's not all romantic. It will be someday.
Yeah.
Well, as people say, what an overnight success. And these grind them out. They're fulfilling and satisfying.
Yeah.
There's no question. But, it's a lot
that's
of
all right.
Fun.
Well, let's keep in mind, the show is called Dirty Secrets of Small Business, and sometimes our entrepreneurs are guys like Michael here who gets his hands dirty for real, folks. That's a big part of this. So mm-hmm. when we come back, we're going to start talking about a little bit in terms of some of the early successes that you guys had and how you started to go from having it be kind of your side hustle to being kind of your full-time thing. We'll talk about that as we get back from this, so stay tuned. I'm Adam Sonhalter.
And I'm Jack Mancini. I look forward to hearing more about Rust Belt Riders.
That's right. Stick around. We got more Dirty Secrets of Small Business coming your way here on Integrity Radio, WINT 1330 AM, 101.5 FM, and online, WINTradio.com. All right. Welcome back to Dirty Secrets of Small Business. I'm Adam Sonhalter.
And I'm Jack Mancini, and I can't wait to hear the second segment here. Rolling right along.
We're here in the studio tonight. We have our guest, Michael Robinson, who's one of the co-owners and co-founders of Rust Belt Riders. And in the first segment, he's kind of giving us a little background in terms of how Rust Belt Riders was formed, and they were literally living it and breathing it and 24/7. Living together, working together, making things kind of happen is a little bit of a side hustle. I wanted to kind of jump in here now, Michael, as we kind of go from you guys are working to pay your bills doing something else. It's kind of something you're figuring out and testing it out. But at some point, you were able to kind of make that jump to where all of a sudden it became a full-time gig. You guys gave up your other jobs. What started happening in order to give you guys the confidence to be able to start to do that? What kind of successes were you guys starting to kind of see or have that made it to where it could be a for-profit business for you guys?
Yeah, I think at this phase, this is really where the support of the communities in Cleveland really helped us to be able to move Rust Belt Riders forward.
Okay.
I think it really started with, we were in the first cohort of Sea Change, the Social Entrepreneurship Accelerator, and it was a program similar to the 10KSB program. And at the end, there was a pitch competition, and we won the pitch competition, so we were awarded a grant for that. And that really allowed us to move forward and build out the physical infrastructure we'd need to be able to meet some of the demand that we were seeing at the time. So everything from technical advice and support, basic, everything from learning income statements and balance sheets to operations and stuff. Having gone through that class, Daniel was the one that took point on that program for us.
So Daniel's and, a partner, okay.
Yeah, so yeah. Daniel went through that, and at that time, with that award, we were able to move forward with our first with the first cargo van, and I remember distinctly, and it's funny because it just wrapped up, but the Cleveland International Film Festival was calling us to see if we could compost all of the compostable plates and cutlery and stuff from the film festival, and we're looking at this bike and trailer going, no way are we going to be able to do that with a trailer. So being able to move to meet that demand was really great. It gave us a much more sophisticated understanding of our business, how it was working, what places that it wasn't working. I mentioned before, there was not a lick of business experience. None of us had really combed through a profit and loss statement or anything like this as we got going. So it was Sea Change, and then one of the things we did too pretty quickly after forming was pulling together an outstanding advisory board. Hmm. We knew that we'd have to get there was a ton of stuff that we didn't know, and if we needed this to be successful, we needed to enlist the support of other very kind people that have given us lots of their time and shared their experience and expertise with us. So assembling that advisory board was really critical. For me, it was I've worked most closely, I think, with Jessica Rose of the Democracy Collaborative, but also Diane Bickett of the Cuyahoga County Solid Waste for Solid Waste. She's been extremely helpful in helping us kind of navigate the world of keeping that material out of landfills. So getting those people that are smarter than us in the room and having their support was also a big piece of us kind of taking that leap.
How big is your board?
The board has, at the moment, I think, 8 active members.
How often do you meet?
Quarterly.
Okay. Yep. Formally. But
yes.
In between, you have a lot of access. And
that's correct.
Okay.
So somebody else that recently joined the board after I finished up with the Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Business Program was my advisor through that program, Steve Siniscalli. Steve's amazing, okay. And he and I get together every couple months. To whether it's troubleshooting a particular issue that I've got, or maybe he's weighing in on some ways that we're taking care of and thinking about production. The advisors have been really, really great about giving us lots of their time and helping us navigate what
it
meant to take that.
Well, that's important, to really keep yourself out of trouble and using that collective experience to open doors and guide you. That's a very important feature here.
Yeah, for those longtime listeners of the show, we actually had Steve Siniscalli in the studio earlier this year, back in January. He was here with Mark Pinto talking about the Goldman Sachs program. And Steve's an ex-banker, but he doesn't come across as he's not what you typically expect from a banker.
Not at all. No, you're right.
Yeah, but very, very good guy. So did somebody suggest that to you, or you guys, in terms of getting a board of advisors or folks you'd kind of talk to, or this is just one of those aha moments like, hey, we need some people, or as you're meeting these people, you mentioned how, and I think when we first met you, Michael, you said, hey, I'm from the Chicago area. I couldn't have done one-tenth of what I've done in Chicago, what I've done here because of the city. So you're talking about some of the folks you're meeting, let's say government circles, mm-hmm. for instance, that they aren't making it difficult for you. They're actually coming in. It sounds like they're embracing you and however we can help, kind of let us know where they've made it very easy for you. And I guess the timing, too, as you're talking about, like the Sea Change and the grant at that point, and all of a sudden you have demand in the marketplace. You got the film festival asking about you and stuff like that. So almost like the stars are starting to align for you guys, saying, "Hey, we gotta, we can't do something else. We got to jump into this thing and see if it's gonna see if it's going to work. Okay.
Yep.
So how long ago was that when you guys went kind of full time at this thing?
Well, that probably would have been, I mean, the nice thing about being in the service industry for me at least, because I was able to slowly kind of dial back the shifts that I was working at the different places. Because
right.
you can, you know, with the service industry, you can hold on to one or two shifts a week, which would be pretty hard to do that kind of part-time in other industries.
True,
it was
okay.
also really great because I was working at restaurants and bars that were actually composting with us.
I was going to say, some of your first customers.
Yeah, okay. Oh, absolutely. So we were working with them, and it was really great to be able to talk about the way that, so the Jukebox, for example, on 29th in Detroit was one of our first accounts, and I was working there for a while and still do a shift over here and there if Alex needs a hand. And to be able to talk about what we do behind the bar and to be able to talk about how the bar, you know, really works hard to be an example of what it looks like to support sustainable, not only sustainable, but regenerative systems.
Right.
And really taking that leap. And folks that are coming into those restaurants, they love that this company is taking the extra step in order to build out that regenerative system. And we really see a big part of our work as promoting the partnerships that we have with the organizations that we work with, because they are really setting the example for what it looks like to have a regenerative system where we're cutting out waste streams as a concept and reviewing them as inputs into other production systems.
Interesting. You know, as he's talking, Jack, I'm hearing him. They have a chance to do some dry runs on presentations to folks at the bar, right? As they're talking about their story,
right.
Can I get
perfect.
The story down,
yeah.
Right? Do you have any interesting stories of folks who maybe joined your board of advisors or gave you some advice that helped you? Folks you just happened to meet on the job,
absolutely,
kind of
absolutely. yeah, I'm trying to think of the best. There was one that I thought was pretty funny. There is a number of people that I met that have been really, really helpful and really great through, his name's Pankaj Ahuja. And Pankaj and I met at that bar while I was working. But the funny thing about this is that there was another guy in the bar who at the time I didn't know him. We were talking about he's like, you know, what do you do during the day? And I was telling him about Rust Belt, and we're talking, and this guy's asking a lot of questions.
And good questions.
They're good questions, yeah, okay. And they're getting pretty detailed. And all of a sudden, he's sending a lot of text messages to this other guy he's sitting at the bar. And I'm like, man, this guy's asking some serious questions. And he's sharing, apparently, my answers with somebody. And the next thing, so Pankaj has worked in startups and had his own for a while. And basically, this guy at the bar was texting Pankaj about, you know, me and my business and what we were doing. And I wound up meeting Pankaj, and Pankaj has just introduced me to a number of people that have been incredibly helpful, been really great supporting me and navigating this along the way. But it's funny because it started out with me being pretty sketched out about, like, what exactly
sure.
was, am I,
sure,
you know, is somebody
going
to, like, take all this and run with it right now? You know, am I saying too much? But it wound up being Pankaj that he was texting, and Pankaj and I have been great friends since then. So that's one instance.
Well, that's a good lesson, mm-hmm. Michael. I mean, you know, we've talked with this a lot, and this actually came up, I think it was a little earlier this week, about owners often paranoid. And there's a healthy paranoia you can have, but it can get really bad.
Oh, to eat
the
you
point
alive.
Where, yeah, and to the point where it becomes paralyzing almost, right? You're afraid to say things, or to your point, if I say this, is that going to, you know, is that the holy grail? Somebody's going to come steal it and do it. And again, what we know, again, you know, this may be another dirty secret alert to try to kind of get stuff kind of going on here, but there's a, it's the hard work, the blood, sweat, and tears. You know, ideas are fantastic, right? But to take an idea and turn it into a business, okay, it's not something you do overnight, you know?
Yep.
And so that's where it becomes, you know, people often miss that part of it. So it's okay to talk, because part of talking about stuff is helping to get it out of your head, and you start to try to articulate it, and you start to see, does it start to hold water? Do people understand what I'm saying, right? Because, you know, as you're learning about stuff, and people often get real excited about their products. Well, most people have no clue. Like, you know, Jack and I were taking a tour of a salon yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell we have a lot of use for salons, right?
I was complaining you like my new color?
I was complaining on the way out. I said, hey, I came in the full head of hair, and I said, I'm not real happy about this, right? But people love their products, so they're kind of going to all kinds of great detail about what they do. I'm like, happy to hear about it, but, like, I don't know, you know? And so you start speaking different languages, and it's like, who knows? But if you can able to articulate to somebody, somebody you're just meeting, you don't know what their background's going to be. If they can understand what you're talking about, that's a good sign. If they get excited about it, that's a good sign too, to kind of see what's happening. So,
yeah.
So yeah, so be able to kind of do that. So maybe, you know, it's a good startup.
Well, like we always say, you can't learn basketball by reading a book. You have to play it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I could tell you the secrets of our coaching, which we do. We're very open about our secrets. Because it's going to take quite a while, if ever, for anybody, even who's in the business, to replicate what we do.
Yeah.
And that's true for most small businesses especially. Very difficult. And the bigger the company, the more difficult it is. But yet, owners of small businesses are, to your point, a little paranoid, or a lot of paranoid.
Yeah.
Like, hey, I can't tell you this. And they clam up. And
yeah.
What could be a great relationship and advance both causes kind of lays dormant, doesn't make it. So.
Yeah.
All right, that's good. Let me just wrap this segment up, because we have about a minute to go here before we hit our next break. I mean, it's great to hear. I mean, to your point, it's something that I think we know. I think people often forget, and Jack, you mentioned it. You know, folks from this area can often be very apologetic for being from this area, and it's often folks like you, Michael, that come from the outside and say, "What's the matter with you folks? This is a great place to be. It's a great community. It's, yeah. You know, it embraces people, has a lot of good values in terms of what folks are doing. It's a great place to be." So folks don't necessarily maybe appreciate what they have. So it's very important to keep that in mind. So, all right, when we come back from break, what we're going to do is we're going to delve into the Goldman Sachs 10 for 10 segment here, which we'll talk about how that happened for Rust Belt Riders, kind of talk through that, and we'll get some more detail from Michael on that. So stay tuned. I'm Adam Sonhalter.
I'm Jack Mancini, and you can be part of the program by texting or calling us at 440-946-9468. Text or call. Either way, you'll connect and be part of this.
All right, stick around. We got more Dirty Secrets of Small Business coming your way here on Integrity Radio, WINT 1330 AM, 101.5 FM, and online, wintradio.com. All right, all right. We're back here on Dirty Secrets of Small Business. I'm Adam Sonhalter.
I'm Jack Mancini.
And we're going to be doing our Goldman 10 for 10 corner here. We're going to be talking to Michael about Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Business Program, of which he's an alum. And I wanted to start out by, how'd you hear about the Goldman Sachs program, and kind of where were you guys at in your business where you said, hey, this might seem like a good idea?
Yeah, so I'm pretty sure that it was a referral either from Ben Biebenroth at Spice Kitchen and Bar or Adam Wright at Restore, which is a juice bar downtown.
Okay.
I think I had gotten an email from somebody with a little bit of information about the program. At that point, we were all starting to, you know, settle into the different seats, the different roles that we had in the business.
Okay.
I think that the business had matured at that point where we were really identifying, instead of it kind of being all hands on deck, everybody's basically got to be able to do anything because, you know, things are changing pretty quickly and certain roles weren't, you know, routine enough at that point to where it was, you know, we have somebody in a finance seat and this is the clear kind of job description, roles and responsibilities of somebody in that position, because we were all basically doing everything.
Okay.
So as we started to break that off into chunks, I found myself settling into the finance seat.
Okay.
And previously Dan had gone through the Sea Change program. Dan had gone through a Jumpstart Core City Impact program, which was similar, and it was kind of like I was up, and now that we were kind of solidifying these different positions, there was a spot for me to be able to continue to focus and own something in particular. But the 10KSB program wasn't just on finance, it was on all facets of the business, and I think as we were maturing, it made a lot of sense for us to apply. We actually were declined the first time. I think we were just a little short on the revenue, the minimum revenue that you'd have to be doing every year, so I applied the next year, and we hit it, and we got in, and it was great.
Okay, so you've been kind of looking around a little bit, and had been exposed to some things, and said, hey, this seems like this is another kind of next step in that process.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you kind of get in there, second time through, you walk in, you know, what was your initial impression walking into that room? I mean, you know, did you have any idea what to expect when you walked in? Was it awkward? Was it scary? Was it no big deal? You know, what were you thinking when you first walked in that room?
I remember getting the giant binder that comes with the program, and that was certainly intimidating. But at the same time, I was excited for that challenge. This was all very new space for me, both in terms of, you know, I'd read a couple of books. Financial Intelligence was probably the first one that really helped me start to wrap my head around the importance of the three different finance reports and having a more nuanced understanding of those. But it was intimidating at first, but I was excited because it meant that it was gonna, you know, I needed to kick my butt a little bit, and it did. So,
well, you'd be happy to know that I understand they now have that all electronically, so they don't spook everybody with the big binder at the beginning, so you don't maybe notice how much stuff you're gonna have to learn.
Yeah.
Where it's a couple hundred pages, I think.
It's huge. Say, and, yeah, right. I mean, it sits on my desk. I mean, all my notes are in it. It's on my desk right next to my computer.
All right, so again, and as we talk about this program over a number of shows, folks, this is a fire hose of business. You know, as Michael's saying, it's not just finance. It covers a lot of the capacities of business. It's basically a day plus a week where you're in class, and they're filling your head with a lot of good stuff. And so if you're ready for it, it can be pretty good stuff. So as you look back now, you know, did you have, you know, one or two kind of key takeaways in terms of, hey, this was, you know, fantastic, you know, it opened my eyes? Were there certain kind of key things that you took away from the program?
Yeah, I think the first two that come to mind, and the first one is their class, I believe, was 8 hours a day, 8 hours for a day weekly. And then there were also some other programming where you could go kind of voluntarily work on some other things. So it might be, you know, it was a workshop on getting in front of lenders or a workshop on sales or something, you know, specific that was optional. And I always wanted to make sure that I took advantage of those because they were great resources.
Right.
And putting that time into those classes and working on the business instead of in the business forced me to have a Friday where I didn't go in. And having been on a bicycle actually hauling the food scraps previously, to kind of like stepping outside of it and looking at it from this other perspective was immensely helpful. And it also kind of helped with that. You'd mentioned that paranoia earlier, mm-hmm. which is a very real thing. But knowing that I was going to be in that classroom, and our whole team knew that's where I was going to be that day. And it helped us to kind of plan things, but it also helped me kind of relax and know that, to realize the importance of getting that other perspective on the business, but also knowing that, like, when roles and responsibilities are clearly defined, you know, I shouldn't have to, none of us should have to be worrying about those kinds of things. We should be able to step outside of the business, get that other perspective, and work on things, work on the business instead of in the business.
You were able to bring clarity to your other partners and be able to present and rationalize this for all of you, since none of you have had good backgrounds in business.
Right.
Yeah, that's very important, very important.
Yeah, and the team was really great about that, too. They knew that I was going to be, you know, going through this, and after the first couple of weeks, I was like, holy cow, you know, I was really trying to give everybody downloads when I got back, because I was trying to, it was great to talk with them about how taking a, you know, the module on flow charts in the production process, and Steve and I actually just talked about this a couple weeks ago, being able to sketch out that process of production. So for us, the food scraps come in, they get processed, screened,
sure,
bagged.
You see those steps, and all of you do it together, and it's tremendous communication, tremendous knowledge. Like, wow, you know? You learn like you couldn't otherwise learn. Flowcharting is tremendously powerful.
Yeah.
You know, to just use that one example. Yeah.
And you can break it down into its component parts, too. And when you're doing that, you might have taken a piece of those, you might have taken one of those steps for granted. But when you're kind of breaking it all out, you can take a look at one specific piece and say, how can we make this better? Are we doing this right?
Absolutely.
And that was really helpful. So,
right, like you mentioned, like the food coming in. Okay, let's take that and break that into the 17 steps to make those things happen and the possibilities that are there. So it's stuff you were kind of maybe doing the hard way, maybe not doing it as much. All of a sudden you became aware, hey, there's different ways to kind of do this or look at it, or hey, there's a tool for this, or there's proven ways to make stuff. We don't necessarily need to reinvent stuff all the time and say there's certain ways. So that perspective was a big part of it for you, to kind of say, hey, there's other ways to do it and kind of be aware of it.
Okay. Yeah, and to be able to hit pause. I mean, when you're in it and you're you know, everything is kind of going a mile a minute, and to be able to take that Friday for 10 KSB and step outside and say, I'll take this perspective on it right now, and I'm working more and more on continuing to just make sure that time is there to be able to see the forest from the trees.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a common challenge for a lot of owners. They're afraid if they do leave the business that things are going to go bad, and it's a common fear. So I think that's your point. They're forcing you to kind of come out. I'm sure your buddies maybe were busting your butt a little bit. Hey, goes Michael screwing off again, going to class again.
Right. Yeah,
I got it. We're all here sweating our butts off, yeah. And he's got it. Yeah, right. Okay.
I got a button up on. Right.
I'm right. Not, no. You better bring some good stuff
some
back.
Slacks.
Matt.
Yeah. Right.
So overall, very, very, very good program, it sounds like. So was there anything that you wish the program maybe did differently, either maybe as part of the program or maybe after the program, that you said, hey, gee, I wish we didn't, you know, we could have done this or done that? Anything that kind of jumps out in terms of things that they could have done differently or maybe?
You know, I feel like the cohort that I was in, too, was really great. That group's, you know, basically has like a social event organizing committee that gets together. Okay. So everything from, you know, the work that was done in the program to this support of that community afterwards has been really great. As I try to, you know, find some ways to improve, it's tough. Nothing really jumps out. I got a lot from it. I'm happy. Still working with Steve too, so it's been really great. The community, the cohort and support there, the support from the advisors, and what's come along with that. Really, I'd mentioned before there was the, you know, forest from the trees, working on the business, not in the business. The other big takeaway was you're being equipped with a set of tools to test out a new idea to roll out for the business. Okay. And you're going to vet this idea. And that was what was so. Another one of the great things about it was we were translating this, you know, larger subject of introducing a new business opportunity and then applying that specifically to a piece of our business.
Right, okay.
And walking through that process. And not only was that really helpful for that particular business opportunity or expansion opportunity, but we've now been through that process of vetting the idea, modeling out the idea. We can do that for any other next move as well. So it's now that program is over, I still have that binder. I'm still working with Steve, so whenever something else comes across, we're able to use that very methodical way of analyzing a potential opportunity and set it up for success.
Yeah, you'll find there's a commonality in business, a big part of business. You know, things are done the same regardless of what the product is. The only real difference is the product.
Yeah.
And same fundamental things have to be done, receivables, payables, the many parts of the business. You learn those and master them, and you can grow any way you want. You know, you really can.
Another really cool thing of that, the cohort, was that there were, like you're saying, there are many pieces that are similar. The product is different. So the cohorts are also lots of different kinds of businesses. So here we are, we're, you know, making healthy soil out of food scraps. And then you've got, you know, there's another company that installs windows. There was a funeral home. There was some people that were doing everything from marketing to food production. And to have all of these people with different types of businesses have their perspective on the challenges of your business, it's really great to have them bring that perspective from whatever product they're working in. Mm-hmm. And if you start to think about, you know, this from the perspective of somebody that's been working in their business, they come up with really novel solutions to problems that you wouldn't have come up with on your own, for sure.
It's just so interesting. I mean, that's what we see in our coaching business all the time. The variety of niches and the knowledge that can come from that, it's applicable on so many fronts, and it's fun. It's fun to get that.
Yeah.
So if I can try to paraphrase here, we got about a minute to go here in this segment. You know, some of your big takeaways were just the overall perspective, having a framework that you can now kind of go back onto in terms of here's what we can do. We can plug in any opportunity. And as we were talking before we got in the air here, Michael, we were talking about the idea of maybe having a nonprofit as a thing. That same framework would apply to nonprofits as well. And then I'll keep using that word perspective. As you're talking to your fellow scholars, I think it's the official term mm-hmm. that they use, right, who are in the class, you start to say, I can learn a lot from these folks. They have a different perspective. They put their glasses on and see the world a little different than I do
yep.
because they've had a different experience. And even though we aren't in the same business, there's some nuggets that are in there. There's some good experience in there that can be very helpful for us to be able to kind of plug back into our business and do very well. So. That's fantastic. Okay, so that's our Goldman 10 for 10 segment for this evening. And what we'll do is we'll come back after the break. We're going to talk more about what the future holds for Rust Belt Riders. We're about 5 years into this business, folks. We got a lot of things that are happening and a lot of good, exciting things to talk about. We'll let Michael share some of that when we come back here. So stay tuned. I'm Adam Sonhalter.
And I'm Jack Mancini, and I can't wait to hear the future.
All right. We got more Dirty Secrets of Small Business coming your way, so stay tuned here on Integrity Radio, WINT 1330 AM, 101.5 FM, and online, wintradio.com. All right. Welcome back to Dirty Secrets of Small Business. I'm Adam Sunhalter.
And I'm Jack Mancini, and we're rounding the corner here.
There we are. That's right. We're in our last segment here. We've got our final segment here with Michael Robinson from Rust Belt Riders. He's been sharing the story with us of Rust Belt Riders and sharing the last segment, kind of his experience with the Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Business Program. And we wanted to have the last segment here to have give Michael a chance to kind of talk about what the future might hold for Rust Belt Riders. Again, 5 years into the company right now. But they got some pretty exciting things kind of going on, what you guys are looking to be able to do. So why don't you kind of give us a little sense of what the next maybe couple of years might look like in terms of what you guys are working on.
Yeah, so we are coming into the warmer weather, and we're very excited about that. A lot of our work is done outside, and it's always nice when it warms up. It also means that people are planting, and whether that's flower beds or your gardens. And this year, we actually kind of separated out the soil blend piece of the business. So we have Rust Belt Riders, which is the food scrap hauling and composting.
Okay.
But then we've got, we just kind of had to break it out for marketing and branding reasons. It got a little muddy. Rust Belt Riders doesn't really sound like a food scrap hauling company. It really doesn't sound like a compost company or a soil company. And we're going to hold on to it for sure.
Yeah.
But we had to kind of break out the soil sales. So that's Tilth. Soil.com.
T-I-L-T-H?
Yeah, soil? T-I-L-T-H.
Okay.
And that's where we have our soil blends available for purchase. We have three different soil blends this year that we're rolling out.
This is the first year for that?
Yeah, we did a little bit of compost sales last year, just regular compost sales. The difference this year is that the different soil blends are tailored for different uses. So I'd mentioned Dan in the past. Jesse Williams was the first one to join us on the logistics side. So Jesse's our director of hauling operations. He's outstanding. We just recently started working with Joe King. Joe King's also helping on the logistics end of things, and he's also a botanist. So he's helping do tests of the compost that we're making. And then Nathan Rutz joined a couple years ago now, and Nathan is our director of soil. And Nathan has...
Great title.
Yeah. He's a...
director of... soil or dirt or anything
director
like that,
right? No, soil. No, we don't dirt. Dirt's it. He'll get mad. He'll get real mad.
He'll get mad at
we
me.
Get th- we get some thrown at us if he were around here. No, director of soils, and he's worked studied under one of a handful of compost microbiologists, Dr. Elaine Ingham. He's been out to tour the Vermont compost site with Carl Hammer, so he knows so much about soil biology and the soil ecosystem, the living organisms that are really what help us to grow food and keep our ecosystems alive.
What are the three categories that you mentioned?
Yeah, so the first one is blended for starting seeds and transplanting houseplants. And the name of that product is called Sprout. And Sprout is made with our compost and then a number of other soil amendments that are really good for sprouting seeds and houseplants. The second is called Grow, and Grow is our compost along with some peat moss. And the peat moss helps to retain moisture, and it's perfect for raised beds. So Sprout is the seed starting product and houseplant soil. Grow is the raised bed, a little bit more coarser compost material. And then the last one is called Base, and Base is an inoculated mulch. So it's not dyed. As it goes through the compost process, it gets darker. So it is a darker wood chip looking mulch. I mean, they are wood chips, but the color is a little bit darker because I know a lot of people are interested in how that color is going to age. And they might purchase dyed black ones or dyed red ones in the past. But the really great thing about this mulch is that it has all of the beneficial soil biology from the composting process. So we view those products as they get analyzed under a microscope for each batch, because the important thing for us about compost is that you're introducing organisms into your soil, and it's having a biodiversity of organisms in soil that allow us to have healthy soils and then healthy plants.
So this is coming from a philosophy major, Jack. He's talking like
I know. I could always take off on that, but is this sold in bulk or do you package it?
We package it
in smaller sizes for consumer use, and
so we do a bit of both. We package it in 40-quart bags, the big ones that people are used to seeing at the hardware store, the Home Depot, or whatever the bigger bags. But then we also do smaller bags, so that if you're just trying to replant a house plant at your house, you might not need that big 40-quart bag. But then if you need a cubic yard, you can give us a call, and we'll be able to set you up with a cubic yard as well. So a lot of people, if you're doing, three or four raised beds in your backyard, you're probably going to want to do a couple cubic yards of grow for that. Mm-hmm. So,
Let me just interject real quick, because I was joking about being a philosophy major, but one of the things you guys have done, you brought some scientists on board, and one of the things you mentioned when we first met with you, Michael, you guys have been doing a lot of learning, and you mentioned tapping, I think it was Ohio State's agricultural school, was it MIT? School?
I took some courses through MIT, as well.
So, again, folks, this is for the audience, one of the keys here is the continual learning. Once you get into something that you start to learn about, you find people, but you also educate yourself about it. So, again, here's Michael able to talk about this stuff, sounding like he's a scientist to the great unwashed like us, because you've studied and have a sense to be able to do it, and you communicate it well. So I understand what you're talking about, which is the key thing. So we got some soils now. So we got tilthsoil.com. What else we got kind of going on that's happening here?
So we're looking to keep a higher percentage of materials out of landfills. We're hoping to expand our processing capacity and continue to grow our collections and have more locally made compost available for growers. So that's going to be our next move. Hopefully we'll be moving that direction early next year. But we just recently brought on, so we're working with the Cleveland Clinic now. We work with UH. We started working with the Quicken Loans Arena a few months ago. So
You mean the Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse that they always changed?
They changed the name again.
They always changing that, like the Q. Yeah. I was going to call it the Q. I was going to call it Jacobs Field. So I was going to be Jake. They'll change it. But yeah, so those are some pretty big customers in terms of a good thing you guys aren't on your bicycles anymore.
Absolutely not. So just continuing to expand that processing capacity for ourselves, keeping more food scraps out of landfills, and then building out regenerative food systems here in Northeast Ohio.
All right, so right now you guys have been limited by just the smaller footprint that you have now, and you guys are starting to look, I know you mentioned you guys are looking to get a bigger space.
Yeah, that's correct.
And so for those of you who don't know, again, Rust Belt Riders is right in the heart of the city, folks. It's on just on the east side of the city, right there in the city. And it's one of the things I think people maybe they think about compost and what happens, and it's one of the things like, well, that's fine, but not in my backyard kind of thing, or it may have some certain things. And so I think part of what you guys are doing, you're educating people about how things really work, and some of the side effects. Things are in pretty good shape. But if you guys get to your new space, what kind of a capacity increase are we talking about in terms of multiples? You guys are going to be 10, 20, 30-fold in terms of size, in terms of what you guys are doing today versus what you guys could do with the new space you're looking at? It's a pretty sizable jump, isn't
it? Yeah, so we're currently I'm still having a great time modeling out the opportunities for that site.
You'll get stuck in your spreadsheets. Remember you telling us that.
You'll find me buried in spreadsheets here the next few weeks as we're still working on this. But it'll be a very significant increase. Currently, we're working with the Ohio EPA has this really great regulation that allows you to compost food scraps under 500 square feet. So we're composting in under 500 square feet over in the St. Clair Superior neighborhood right now, and we're in the process of exploring looking to expand that 500 square feet to 8-10 acres. So,
it will be
significant. The nice thing is that as I continue to explore the different production processes, we used to turn these piles by hand with pitchforks, and then once we expanded to the 500-square-foot site, we got a Bobcat. So now we use the Bobcat. And we've worked really intimately with this material. We know food scraps very, very well. We were in it up to our waists quite a bit early on. And we've continued to have a really close relationship with that material. And I feel very, very confident. I feel great about what that expansion looks like, because even though it is a significant spatial expansion, we're really familiar with this material. We've worked really closely with it for a long time, and we've got our processes in a place where we will be able to basically extrapolate what we do now onto that larger facility. And again, with the help of some people that are smarter than we are, that have done this, you know, more than we have, to be able to talk with them and build that out for expansion, I feel really great.
Okay.
Does your source material have to be sorted by the restaurant? I mean, is it, you know, pretty difficult to get that, or do they cooperate pretty well with?
You got 30 seconds to answer that. Sorry. Go ahead.
They do sort it out. They sort it out for us, and they do a really great job. We actually work really hard to get out ahead of a lot of those issues just through robust training programs with back-of-house staff. We've worked in kitchens. We're familiar with how things flow through kitchens, how to move around a kitchen, and how to make it easy. So we work really hard so that it's easy for them to do. And if it's easy for them to do, then we don't wind up with contamination issues. And largely, it's just a non-issue for us.
Very good.
It's amazing. It's a fantastic story, Michael. I'm sorry. We're up against our final hour here. So I'm sure we could have another show. And as you kind of progress, maybe we'll have you back on. But it's amazing. It took all the things you guys have done. And you start to kind of tell the story now. You start to connect some of those dots. You had no idea, even when you're probably doing them, as you start to look back and say, hey, this is important here, and okay, you just made another point there about, hey, we understand what it's like to be working in those kitchens, what's kind of going on. So just the perspective you guys have is fantastic. So, but I want to thank all of you for joining us tonight, and we're here next Wednesday, 7 p.m. Eastern. You can hear us. If you want to get a hold of us in between, you can email us at radio@maximumvp.com or give us a call, 877-849-0670. We're going to have another guest next week. We're going to have Joni Fetters from Aileron, which is a nonprofit that we're going to talk about that helps small businesses. So tune in for that, and you can learn more dirty secrets of small business next Wednesday, 7 p.m. Eastern. Hey, thanks for listening on Integrity Radio, WINT 1330 AM, 101.5 FM, and online, WINTradio.com.